Okay. I think we may have one more person coming, but I'm not sure. So let me give you a little perspective on what my next, this lecture and the next one will be about, and
how they fit in.
And basically, if you were working on data with morphometrics, you're likely to be working at a number of, you could be working at a number of different levels, and people have indicated that they, that some of you are working at some of these levels. One would be within individuals. On development. So you're comparing forms at different developmental stages. By the way, you'll hear the word form and shape in this course a lot. I think Fred may have introduced you, but basically the way I'm going to be using it, and I think the way he uses it as well, is that when you have digitized forms, we call them forms, we only call them shapes if we've removed size, and are somehow standardizing the forms to some common size. So shape is not, I'll be using the word form here. So if you may be comparing forms in development at different developmental stages. Another thing you could be doing is between individuals. So between individuals within populations. So you're looking at variability from individual to individual in a population, and you're asking in what aspects of the form it's varying. Another level would be between populations. So you're comparing forms of individuals, probably mostly adult individuals, although you could be combining these levels. You could be within a species comparing different populations. And finally, you could be going between species. Okay. And as indicated, you could be doing more than one level. In theory, you could be doing all of these, although I'm not sure I've ever seen a study do that. And so the issue comes up as to what processes are creating the differences between these, because if you want to do statistical modeling of some sort, if you have a model-based statistics, which is not inevitable that you have a model-based statistics, but if you want to, you're going to have to consider, well, what are the processes that we would imagine are creating these differences? And what I'm going to talk about today is quantitative genetic variation and the way it's treated mathematically, statistically. And that is relevant really to 2, 3, and 4 up here. Now, we don't really have, that I know of, a good theoretical framework for developmental processes. People are, evo-devo people are interested in that in the abstract, but I'm not sure it's gotten far enough for me to, at least I don't know anything much about it. So what I'll be talking about really is concerned with these last three. And if you're really working on number one, it might be a little irrelevant. But what I want to do is talk about the ways people have made a theoretical machinery that works with the population genetics and roughly describes variation in quantitative traits. Now, for some of you, this is review, because if you've had my population genetics course, theoretical population genetics course, which has been every two years, it's being given next quarter for what will be the last time before my retirement. And in it, at the very end of the course, I do a week on this. So what I'm going to give you today is basically a week of the theoretical population genetics course, equivalent of it, in one lecture. And then we'll go on to do some further material in the next lecture. And we're going to start out historically by with these guys, and they are Francis Galton, Carl Pearson, R.A. Fisher, and Jay Lush. I'll describe what they've done. Now, you've heard a lot about Galton and Pearson already from Fred, because they were heavily involved in the late 1800s, from about 1889 on, through the 1910s. Galton died, I think, in 1911. Pearson was his protege and successor. And they are notorious for having invented and pushed eugenics. They're the original, not the original people to talk about manipulating human heredity, but they gave it a name, eugenics, and pushed it and were very enthusiastic about it. And they loved to measure people. One of the things that they did, they were both, Galton was at University College London, and so was Pearson. And they maintained a storefront nearby, and they would lurk in this storefront. And whenever people walked by the storefront, they'd come pouncing out of the store and talk them into coming in to have their skulls measured. And so they collected large amounts of data this way, and they used it in their analyses. Nowadays, we'd regard that as a horrifically bad sampling strategy. Apparently, the collections of Galton's and Pearson's papers at University College Library include book after book after book of their data. They had ledger books that they wrote their data, and the data are still sitting there. Now, what they were trying to do in the process of dealing with multiple measurements on people, they were trying to work out a theory of heredity. They did not use Mendelian principles, because when they started, nobody knew that Mendel had, people had ignored Mendel's paper. It was more or less unknown. They came up with regression formulas. In fact, I should say, the word regression is coined by Galton for the relationship between parents and offspring. If you are 6 inches above average in height, your offspring will on average be maybe 3 inches above average on height, so the amount of excess over the population mean has regressed towards the mean. And so there was the coefficient of the slope that he needed, he called the coefficient of regression. But in the process of doing this, they invented many of the tools of multivariate statistics. And so they're really historically important in that way. However, and they had their law, Galton had in 1889 his law of ancestral heredity, which was basically a regression formula, regressing, predicting your phenotype by the means of your parents, the mean of your two parents and the mean of your four grandparents and the mean of your eight great-grandparents. And they had coefficients that they put into these formulas. From the point of view of modern quantitative genetics, the mistake they made was to think that the coefficients should be the same for all traits. That we would now say, well, different traits have different heritabilities, and as we're going to see, that affects the regression of parents on offspring. They kept trying for a universal formula, which was not really to be achieved. And when Mendelian genetics came along, in 1900, when several people announced that several people pointed to Mendel's papers of the 1860s and verified that those worked experimentally, and suddenly Mendelian genetics was available. Pearson became, who was more active than Galton at that point, Pearson became a big skeptic of Mendelian inheritance and kept saying things like, well, that's okay for these bizarre large discrete morphological differences, but the stuff of everyday variation of how high a person is, for example, how tall a person is, or their weight, or ratios of different parts of the body. That works by these laws of ancestral heredity, by this more normal means of variation, and then this Mendelian stuff is just bizarre. Pearson actually assigned some students to try to work on Mendelism and try to figure out what its implications would be for quantitative traits. And he made a little bit of progress. So paradoxically, although he was opposed, he was a big opponent of Mendelian genetics, I'm coughing because of a dry throat and I do not have anything infectious. Although he did it, he actually contributed to the successful explanation of quantitative characters by Mendelian means. But the guy who made the huge impact on this, there was also work by Wilhelm Weinberg in 1910, the guy who was also the Weinberg of Hardy-Weinberg laws. But the guy who made this tremendous advance was R.A. Fisher. You've probably heard of him, the famous founder of theoretical population genetics, along with Sewell Wright and J.B.S. Haldane, and also, of course, Fisher was the great figure of mathematical statistics and has been called the greatest mathematical scientist of the 20th century. Fisher, in 1918, wrote a paper in the Transactions of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. He tried to get it into the proceedings of the Royal Society of London and didn't succeed. The referees were not happy with it. So he went to the Transactions of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, published this big paper. It would be wonderful if it would be possible for everybody to say, oh, I'm going to learn about quantitative genetics. Let me start by reading Fisher's paper. But if you do, you will be driven crazy. Because Fisher he did a lot of stuff in his head. He had very poor eyesight, he was nearly blind, so he tended to do work in his head. And in that paper, it contains brilliant insights, but in the paper, every time he says, obviously, you know you're in for a hard day of algebra, basically. And people have assembled seminars that spent a whole quarter trying to work their way through Fisher's paper. It's really very incomprehensible, but people have gradually worked out what he was talking about. And I'll give you a picture of that in a moment. I'll also mention later on Jay Lush, who was the guy who took the quantitative genetic theory that Fisher put forward and applied it in the 1930s to modern animal and plant breeding, and wrote a book called Animal Breeding Plans, which was the sort of Bible of quantitative genetics inspired animal breeders and plant breeders. And in that process, he was working, he was the head of the very important, what became a very important group at Iowa State University, working from the 1930s on, and on through the 50s and 60s. And his students were the major people in quantitative genetics, and people in other countries who were training tended to come to Iowa State. My postdoc advisor, Alan Robertson, working in Edinburgh early in his career, was sent off to, packed off to Iowa State to learn quantitative genetics, so it was the place to go. Fisher, as we'll see, Fisher's model is very closely related to analysis of variance, and that's not an accident because, of course, Fisher invented analysis of variance, and he did so at just about the same time that he proposed his model and worked out its consequences. So let me go on to Fisher's scheme. And basically what Fisher did was to say, well, let us approximate the inheritance of a quantitatively measurable trait as a sum of parts contributed by different loci without necessarily being specific about how many loci there are. Because what we're going to see is we'll assume we know tremendous amounts about how many loci and exactly what they're doing, but then in the end you derive some rules that enable you to connect observables to each other in a way that doesn't depend on your knowing all this stuff. And I'll try to get there directly. So what we're going to say is that this, there is a character that we're measuring, maybe the length of my forefinger. And we're going to imagine it, it is determined in the following way. There is a start, an arbitrary starting point, which for the values, the example I'll be giving here, we're going to take to be the number 4, but it could be any number. It could be the population mean, but doesn't have to be. And then each locus contributes an amount that depends on its genotype. Now here I've shown 2 alleles, but you could have any number of alleles. And let's imagine you somehow know this table here that says a big A subtracts 2, a heterozygote adds 0, and a little a adds 3. And you have a similar table for loci B and C and D and E. And those tables are arbitrary. You could have any pattern of dominance or overdominance you want. Here, for example, little d is gives you a larger number, but it's recessive to the others. Here is an overdominant locus that has its highest contribution come from the heterozygote. Here, the little a makes the highest contribution. Heterozygote somewhat intermediate, but a little bit closer to big A, which is minus 2. So you have arbitrary patterns of dominance, but what you're assuming is that each locus is simply adding something to the trait. And what that's doing is to ban interactions between loci. Now, somebody could jump up and say, well, but we know that there are lots of interactions between genes. How can we do this? And the answer really is, yes, they're really there, but this does a good job of approximating what's going on for the first cut. And it gets you some results that are tractable. There are ways of trying to get at interactions, but they're maddeningly difficult. They have maddeningly low power, statistical power, which is another way of saying that this single locus contributions, this model of single locus contributions comes pretty close. There isn't all that much statistical information left to it to actually look into the interactions among loci. And then we're also going to assume that the effect of the environment is just randomly chosen for that individual from some distribution. Now, I've shown a kind of normal distribution here, but it's some distribution that has a mean and will make it a mean of 0. And then there'll be a contribution chosen for that individual. Now, in a very naive model, we make those independent from individual to individual. And of course, in real life, that's very much not true. Because, for example, if you're working in a natural population and you have a mother mouse and a daughter mouse, they share some environment, and so there will actually their environmental effects are going to be not independent and uncorrelated, but we're going to start out by assuming that they're independent and uncorrelated. And if you had all these tables in this distribution, then you could generate phenotypes for different genotypes. So here we we take this genotype here and we say, okay, let's work out what the phenotype will be, and it's pretty straightforward. Here is the genotype down here. Here's the E locus, and the E locus contributes 0.3. The A locus contributes minus 2 because it's big A. The C locus contributes 6. The D locus contributes 0.7. And finally, the B locus contributes 0.1. So you basically go through these tables and add up these numbers. But you need an effect of the environment as well. And in this case, we draw it, and let's say it comes out to be 0.9. So that's just a draw. So in that case, you get a number 10. You could also look at this one here, and you go through and do the same thing. This is another set of choices. And you get 8.8. And you could keep going, and you could imagine this process coming up with a phenotype for a set of genotypes, a set of individuals on a particular genotypes. So if you knew all this stuff, you could imagine creating phenotypes for individuals in a population. Now, we're going to be assuming that these individuals are in a population which is random mating and has been random mating long enough that they're, and there's no perturbations of the gene frequencies by other evolutionary forces. So for the moment, we're banning all sorts of evolutionary forces, including genetic drift, including selection, mutation, and migration. And we're going to assume, therefore, if you have a random mating population, it's a big population, the at each locus, the genotype proportions will be in Hardy-Weinberg proportions. So we'll assume Hardy-Weinberg proportions. And we're also assuming no linkage disequilibrium, or for if you're into genomics, people don't tend to call it that. They call it LD by its initials. No covariation, no correlations between the presence of a genotype at one locus and the presence of a genotype at another locus. They are independent. So with all these independence assumptions, we can start to look at expressions for the variation. Before I do that, I just wanted to mention that another model, which we won't actually make much use of in this course, but is worth knowing about, is an additional model by Sewell Wright, who said, well, you could have this scheme, and if you're trying to explain a discrete character which has a polygenic basis, it depends on multiple loci, you could simply say that there's an underlying quantitative character which has come to be called the liability, which you cannot observe, but that there's a developmental threshold, and if you set the developmental threshold, say, to 9, then you say if you're above 9, the character you see is state 1. If you're below 9, you see state 0. So it predicts a set of discrete phenotypes with an underlying polygenic genetic basis, multiple genes affecting developmental processes, and then finally a developmental threshold of some sort. Predicting this discrete, these two discrete states. But I'm not going to go into that because it won't affect us very much at this stage. Now, if you make models like Fisher's, you can also get a feel for when quantitative genetic analyses are helpful. If you had, for example, a single locus that had three genotypes, they're in a population in Hardy-Weinberg proportions. There is an allele which, when homozygous, makes you have phenotype 2. Heterozygote might have phenotype 4, the other homozygote phenotype 5, and a little bit of environmental variation. If you had a situation like that with only one locus and with very little environmental variation, you could say, well, it's a quantitative character, but look, its distribution is these three bumps. And if I see an individual in one of those bumps, I pretty much know what the genotype is. In a situation like this, you would not use quantitative genetics. You would simply say, well, let's just try to work on the Mendelian genetics of that trait. But if you then say, well, suppose there's a bit more environmental variation, what distribution will we see in the population in that case? Well, what I've done actually here, just to come up with not always using normal distributions, I said, well, suppose these distributions here are not normal but log normal. That is, they're normal on a logarithm scale. But we're back on the original scale, and that makes them different widths and somewhat skew. And what happens is, as you increase the environmental variation, you might get into this state where you've got a bump that is clearly one genotype, and the other two genotypes, their distributions have started to merge, and you can't clearly see. If you find an individual somewhere between 4 and 5, you're not sure which of those two genotypes it is. So here you're in an intermediate state in which Mendelian genetics is starting to become less useful. And finally, if you fatten those environmental increase the environmental variance, in this case the variance on the log scale, you get a distribution that looks like this. Now, if you're trying to work on that trait, you're probably best off using quantitative genetic methods, because it's going to be very hard. It might be possible doing a lot of fitting of things, of traits to pedigrees, to figure out what the genotypes are and what their means and variances are. But you're starting to get into the realm of quantitative genetics. Another example here, suppose I take a bunch of loci that are acting additively, as in Fisher's original trait. Each locus has complete dominance, so there is one allele that's dominant over the other. They all have the same effect. And then there's an environmental variance added, in this case, normally distributed. Well, if you look at a case of one locus, where there's really only one locus doing that, you'd see, well, there are two genotypes. This allele might be dominant over that allele, let's say. And you would get, if you put in enough environmental variance so that of the total resulting variance, 30% of it is genetic, and the 70% is environmental, then you get a distribution that looks like this. Now, if you take instead, say, well, suppose there were two loci contributing to the trait, and what we're going to do is standardize it so it has the same mean, the same overall variance, and the same fraction of variance coming from the genetic part, which we'll see a little bit more explicitly. Well, if there's two loci, the distribution is going to start looking like that. It's got recognizable bumps. If there's five loci, the little peaks start to be rather more and merge with each other. Again, we standardize it so it's the same mean and the same overall variance and the same proportion of genetic variance. Finally, get up to 10 loci, and you just can't tell it from a normal distribution. There's no way you could tell 10 loci from a million loci in this, at least with many of the manipulations that you could do. So you get a feeling that the more loci are involved in a trait, the harder it's going to be to analyze by Mendelian genetic methods. So this is a rationale for going ahead and doing what we're going to do. Here's another case where what I did is make two loci interact with each other. Here are the means that you get for each two locus genotype, and then with some assumptions about gene frequencies and log normal environmental variances, you could see a situation where you start out with a lot of spikes that are different for the different genotypes, but it doesn't take very much environmental variance. In this case, it merges together and it seems to have only three peaks. So you might look at that and say, oh, it's a single locus, but it isn't. It's coming from this table. And then here again, finally, you get a distribution with where the Mendelian genetics has more or less gone away. Okay. So what we're going to do is look at a thing that Fisher did to break down the variance components, and it appears to be magic. It's a set of rather arbitrary things that you do, and you define some variance components. And then it turns out that covariances between relatives, in effect correlations between relatives once you rescale them, can be predicted from this. And it looks as if it's useless because it's going to assume you know everything that there is to know about every locus. But then, in the end, the rules for the covariances are going to give you relationships between observables without you knowing these things. So what we're going to do is imagine one of those loci in a Fisherian additive scheme. And we're going to make a graph where we count the number of There's two alleles here. One is called big A1 and the other is called big A2. We're going to count the number of copies in three different genotypes. There's a two allele situation. So here's big A1, big A1. It gets you on average this phenotype. This is a phenotype scale. And we're going to plot the mean phenotype of individuals with that genotype. Okay. here's the mean phenotype of individuals with the heterozygote that has one copy of it. The other homozygote has zero copies of A1. And so we'll start out with these three dots. And then what Fisher says is do the following. And we just at the moment have to say, for the moment, we have to say, yes, Fisher, we'll do it because of your, we'll take it on your authority. And he says, fit a straight line to these. But don't just weight the 3 points equally. Weight them according to their Hardy-Weinberg proportions. So if you're in a population with a lot of A1 alleles, this point gets a lot of weight, and the line will try to come close to that point. If you're in a population with a lot more A2s than A1s, the weights will be different, and the straight line will be trying harder to come close to that point. So the weights will be equal to the Hardy-Weinberg proportions in this random-naming population. When you do that, with the gene frequencies in the current population, you get some least squares straight line. So it's a conventional least squares, but weighted by these Hardy-Weinberg proportions. And then you can take the predictions, which are these hash marks here, and you can use those to come up with an effect of changing an A1 into an A, sorry, a an A2 into an A1. And you can say, well, in this prediction, if I go from an individual who's a heterozygote and I change it so they're both A1, this will rise by an amount alpha 1. And if I go the other way and change the A1 into an A2, this will drop by an amount alpha 2. Well, actually, I misstated. Serge didn't catch me. He didn't catch me. It's all your fault that I made this mistake. Okay. What this does is it changes you by alpha 1 minus alpha 2. And this also changes by, in this case, if you're going this way, by alpha 2 minus alpha 1. So these increments here are the difference between the two alphas. So you're making a prediction, and this is a sort of additive prediction that says, well, if these points just lay in a straight line with the heterozygote exactly intermediate between the two homozygotes, then the trait would be completely additive and there would essentially be no dominance. But that's not true. These are predictions, but the actual values are here. So there are deviations from the straight line, and those are going to be called dominance deviations. So we have additive effects of the two alleles, and we have dominance deviations. The additive effects, you may wonder, this tells you what alpha 1 minus alpha 2 is. It doesn't really tell you what alpha 1 and alpha 2 are themselves. They're generally standardized so that the average alpha is 0. That's a detail we need not dwell on. Okay, so you have this Fisherian regression, and he fictionally breaks up the effect of having this genotype into two parts, one of which is the alphas, and the other of which is the departure from that line, which is called the dominance deviation. Okay, well, that's fictional. I mean, the actual effect of the genotype is there, and this thing here is not visible in the physiology of the way the genes function or the biochemistry of how they function. But I'm going to go ahead with it anyway. Now, remember the assumptions, which I've just told you about. Random mating, so Hardy-Weinberg proportions, linkage equilibrium, the environmental effects independent of the genotype, environmental effects independent in different individuals. Very, very important assumption and often violated. No interaction between loci. Okay. So effects add up over loci. Although there are dominance effects, interaction of... what happened here? Yeah. And the result of all those assumptions is that when we are working out the effect on the phenotype, which is going to be a big sum of these alphas and deltas and an environmental effect, the two alphas you get at a locus are uncorrelated. And they're uncorrelated because of random mating. What allele you see at the first position is independent of what allele you see at the homologous position. The allele that came from the mother is independent of the allele that came from the father, so any effect of it, like its alpha value, is also independent and uncorrelated. Uncorrelated, by the way, of course, uncorrelated is different from independent, but uncorrelated is what we're going to need. Independent is a stronger condition. They are actually independent in the first case. Now, the weighted least squares regression, it turns out, if you do lots of algebra, by using a least squares, a weighted least squares regression, Fisher has guaranteed that within a locus, the alpha effects are uncorrelated with the dominance deviation. That may not be obvious. The perhaps easy way to see that, let me go back to the picture here. It's a property of a least squares regression that the height of the regression line, that's the prediction, is uncorrelated with the deviation off the line. The least squares happens to be the right choice to have that be true. And the least squares weighted by the genotype frequencies in the population makes it be uncorrelated in that population. So I'm just going to wave my hands and say, trust R.A. Fisher on that one. Let me go back to where we were. Okay. So the alphas and deltas are uncorrelated. They're technically not independent, but that doesn't matter. And, of course, at different loci, because there's linkage equilibrium, the genotypes at different loci are independent, and therefore what alphas you have in an individual and deltas at one locus is completely uncorrelated and independent of what you have at the next locus. And, of course, the environmental effect is independent. So, if I then say, okay, in our Fisherian model, the phenotype that we see is a sum of parts. They are random variables. In this case, they depend upon what allele you got in that individual and what environmental effect you got. And so the result is you get a sum of parts. They're random variables. The starting one is just a starting point. It doesn't vary. It's a constant. But everything else is a random variable dependent upon genotype and on what environmental effect you got when you did your draw from the environment, the environmental distribution. So, then you can say, aha, Fisher, by making this model, has got us a sum of terms that are all uncorrelated with each other. Okay. Now, when things are uncorrelated with each other, their variances add up. They have no covariances. And what you can do before we do that, though, before we figure out the variances, we'll take this sum here and say, well, the other thing you could do is rearrange it. So all we're doing is rearranging. Put all the alphas together into a sum. Put all the deltas together into a sum. I've left off the subscripts here. Oh, and then finally have an environmental distribution. So now you could say we have fictionally broken down the phenotype that you observe into four parts. A starting value, a bunch of the sum of all the additive effects, the sum of all the dominance deviations, and the environmental effect. And by the way, I am wrong to put dot, dot, dot here. There isn't anything there. These are, this dot, dot, dot should be right here after the delta 3. Then it will make more sense. I'll try to change that. So you've now broken it fictionally into four parts. And you might say, well, that's all very well, But we got these parts by doing this weird regression, by assuming that we knew everything. We assumed we knew all the genes involved in exactly what they're doing and exactly what their gene frequencies are. The first part, the sum of the starting point plus A, is called the breeding value and gets used a lot in animal breeding and plant breeding. I said that A is the breeding value. It's actually, I think, mu plus A is the piece of breeding value. Then there's the sum of the dominance deviations, and there's the environmental effect. And if you look at those, you say, well, it's all very well, but you know, what good is it? Well, one thing you can do is you can say, look, since all of these terms are uncorrelated, this big thing in parentheses is uncorrelated with that big thing in parentheses, and they're both independent, uncorrelated with, excuse me, the environmental effect. So these three numbers here are random variables. They're uncorrelated with each other. That means when you take the variance, you say, okay, what variance is going to result? It will be the sum of the variance of this plus the variance of this plus the variance of that. And those are the variance components. And they're called the additive and dominance and environmental variance components. The additive variance, the dominance variance, and the environmental variance. Again, you be within your rights to be skeptical and say, where is this leading us? It's assuming we know all kinds of stuff that we don't, in fact, know. How could it be? I'm repeating this point probably too much. Now, here we come to think about the covariation between relatives. If we go out in the population, or in our breeding herd, or our cornfield, and we collect pairs of relatives, we go find birds that are nesting and mark them and measure them and so on, and we end up saying we know what the mother's, size variable, that's, or the wing length of the mother was, and we know what the wing length of the offspring is, and we collect pairs of relatives, such as parent offspring pairs, full sib pairs, half sib pairs. We could collect others, uncle niece pairs, aunt nephew pairs, and so on. We can then ask whether in this theory is there something we can say about the covariation between those values in the two relatives. And before I do that, I want to remind you of a simple statistical rule, which is if I have a random variable that consists of two parts, x and y, so that's like a wing length and it composes some effects of some stuff and some effects of other stuff, and we'll call those x and y. And I have another one that has a wing length which has some effects of x plus another random variable z. But these x's here are the same. So if there is a shared part of the variation, it will turn out to be true if these are independent of each other, uncorrelated with each other, really, is the proper condition. The covariance between this sum and that sum will be the variance of the part that they share. And that, with that, we can make magical progress on the covariances between relatives. Because if I have two relatives, I'm going to call them little x and little y here. So this might be the mother's wing length, and this might be the offspring's wing length. And the mother's wing length is, of course, a sum of all these alphas, deltas, and epsilon. The offsprings is a sum of alphas, deltas, and epsilons. The environmental effects are being assumed to be independent from individual to individual. But, and the mu's here are just the same number, it's just the starting point. The alphas, however, are interesting because some fraction of the gene copies in the mother are identical by descent to copies in the offspring. It has to be identical by descent, and I've not been talking about identity by descent. But if you look at a parent and their offspring, the parent has contributed one of the two copies of the genes that is in the offspring. And that is there because of identity by descent. Now, it might be that both of those are the A1 allele. It might also be that there's are copies of the A1 allele at the other position in the offspring by accident, simply because they were drawn from the population and has a certain frequency of A1. We're not interested in those. We're interested only in what fraction of the copies that you see in the parent are shared with the offspring because of that parent-offspring relationship, because of identity by descent. Okay. And what you can say is, well, there's a fraction F1, and we'll work out in a moment what it is. There's also a certain, and what it will be is the proportion of the time, the fraction of the time, that a copy that you pick up in the parent would show up identical by descent in the offspring. Now, there's also the probability that both copies in the parent are identical by descent. Well, the problem with parents and offspring is there is zero probability of that. But if I took two full siblings, it is possible that the exact pair of copies that one of them gets is exactly the same alleles identical by descent because they are full siblings. There's a 1/4 chance of that. So there's a probability F2 that the pair of genes in one individual show up identical by descent in the other. You can work it out. You can work out from the Mendelian genetics what that probability is. And I'm going to claim that the covariance, because the covariance of these things is the variance of the parts that are shared, and because all these things are uncorrelated with each other, it will turn out that the covariance between the two relatives is equal to F1 times a fraction F1 of the additive variance and a fraction F2 of the dominance variance. And that's an important result. And now it says that what you've got is a covariance formula for arbitrary relatives. And it's got these numbers F1 and F2 and these numbers VA and VD in it. It doesn't have a detailed account of what all the genes are doing any longer. But it does have these mysterious additive genetic variants and dominance variants in them. And that's what's going to lead us to the usability of the Fisherian machinery. Okay, so taking that, it's very easy, by the way, to tabulate. I didn't do it in the. If you say F1 and F2, and if you have identical twins, what is F1? What is the probability that me and my identical twin, it doesn't exist, but me and my identical twin, if I pick a gene in me, what's the probability that it will show up in my identical twin identical by descent? One. Okay, so F1 is one. What's F2? It's also one, because both genes are definitely there identical by descent. So this is the probability that both genes are there. Okay. Now if I say full sib, what's the probability that a copy in me, if you are my full sib, what's the probability that a copy in me, single copy, is there in you because of identity by descent? It's 1/2, because that gene came from one of my parents, one of our parents, and there's half a chance that they passed it on to you. So this is 1/2. Now, what's this one? I actually told you already. It's not 1/2, no.
1/4.
Sorry?
A quarter.
A quarter. Because there's half a chance that the first copy is identical by descent. There's half a chance that the second, if you sit down and think about what those involve, they involve Mendelian segregations into two different parents, and they're independent of, those are independent of each other by assumption. So a half and a quarter. Half sibs, somebody who shares a father but not a mother, let's say, this turns out to be a quarter, and that's zero. Now again, you could have in half sibs the same allele, but as long as it's not there because of identity by descent, but is just there because in the population drawing two times you happen to get the same allele, that's not a problem. The number here is zero. Parent offspring, what's this number? Parent and offspring. If I have an allele in the mother, what's the chance that I find that copy, that an identical copy of that, descendant of that copy in you? Parent and offspring, one copy on N, one half. Because they're passing on one of their two copies of that locus. Is it that one or the other one? Parent offspring, F2 is zero. And then you can go and you can fill in more. You can fill in first cousins and second cousins and aunts and uncles and nephews and niece and grandparent. Oh, grandparent offspring, I think, is one. Grandparent offspring is a quarter and zero. So it's actually the same as half sib. Okay. So what does this predict? Using these formulas, which are simply a consequence of Mendelian genetics. You can work them out from Mendelian genetics. And you can stick them in here, and you get an expression in terms of these mysterious variance components, given all of the Fisherian assumptions, for all of these covariates. So you're predicting in terms of two, well, really three unknown quantities here. You're predicting the covariances, and there's another thing you can observe that you predict, and that is the variance, which is the covariance of you and yourself. And that is one and one, plus there's a covariance term for environmental variation, because one thing we know under this model is that whatever environment affected you, it also affected you. You're looking at you and yourself, covariance of you and yourself. So there's a covariance, the third covariance term that I didn't write over there is a VE, and that's only for the case of you and yourself. So for the variant, the overall variance of the trait is just the sum, as I wrote earlier, VA plus VD plus VE. And the covariances are these linear combinations of VA and VD. And what that means is the Fisher formula immediately gives you relationships among these covariances. It makes predictions. It predicts, for example, that the half-sib covariance and the grandparent offspring covariance will be identical. It predicts that and what you can do basically is if you measure some of these, enough of these, if you basically measure three, one of which is the variance, you're going to look at your individuals that you measured and get their variance, and two other covariances, you can solve for these three quantities and then use them to make predictions of any other covariance that you want. So suddenly it gives you a relationship between observables. And it'll be in terms of these numbers. Now you must say, okay, if I see a value here of 0.136 for VA, what does that say about how many loci there are affecting the trait? Anybody have a thought on that? Serge can't answer. He knows the answer too well. If I go out and I get a number, does it tell you how many loci, what their patterns of dominance are, what their effects are? You haven't been interrupting me enough, so I'm going to torment you here. Can you tell from the number VA and the number VD and the number VE, which you can get estimates of those numbers, can you tell anything about how, whether this trait is determined by 3 loci plus an environmental effect or 300 loci plus an environmental effect? Okay, the answer is no, you can't. So these are also, on the one hand, they can be estimated, great, but it doesn't actually tell you what's going on at the level of the genes, except in terms of those numbers. And you may think, well, that's terrible. It really doesn't really tell us what's going on. On the other hand, it's usable. You can go back and forth. And then, furthermore, it's robust against your not knowing how many genes are involved and what their gene frequencies are and how many alleles they have and what patterns of dominance they have. You don't need to know any of those things because you have this relationship among observables. Okay, so where we will go with this is, well, first of all, this all looks a lot like with variances being sums of component variances, it looks a lot like the analysis of variance. When I was studying statistics, which is now 50 years ago, analysis of variance was this big thing. Everybody had to learn it. I think that's much less true today. So maybe you'll be less conversant with it. But if you look at analysis of variance, you say, well, who developed it? Answer, R.A. Fisher. When did he develop it? Well, he published his first papers on analysis of variance in the early 1920s, which is just a few years after his 1918 paper. It's clear that all this machinery was in his head at the same time. Each additive effect sort of plays the role of a row or column effect. It's like a multi-way table with one way for each copy of the gene. The dominance deviations are two-way interaction effects between the pair at a locus. All the other interaction effects have been assumed away. And the least squares regression that's used here is the same one you use when you do fixed effects analysis of variance and you're assigning a row effect. You're assigning an effect of a particular being in a particular row or a particular column. So it's all the same machinery in a sense. So, I'm just saying what I said now. They compute F1 and F2, and you get this thing, and you also get the variance. And here is a case that will be important for us. The covariance is apparent in offspring is half the additive variance that's gotten from this one, from this row of the table. So you already saw that. And there is a quantity called the heritability that you will hear about a lot. And you'll see in a moment why that is important. And what it is the fraction of all the variance, the total variance, that comes from the additive genetic variance term. It's not the fraction that is genetic, because that would include the VA and the VD. There's a thing called broad sense heritability that people use to give a name to that. This is the fraction that is additive genetic variance. Now notice the way we determine these is they depend upon the gene frequencies in the population. If I have a set of genotypes and the corresponding phenotypes, I need to know the gene frequencies in order to figure out what the alphas are and what the additive effects are, if I were assuming that magical amount of knowledge. So from population to population, the additive genetic variance of the same trait could be different if the gene frequencies at the loci that are determining the trait are different. It can be different from generation to generation if there's been genetic drift or selection changing the gene frequencies. And in a way, that's good, because you'd like to think that if a population evolves such that it fixes the alleles at all these loci, that everybody's an A1 at the first locus, everyone's a B2 at the second locus, then you'd like to have a situation where there's no genetic variation at all if all the genotypes are the same, and sure enough, that's true in this scheme. The heritability is called little h squared. Sewell Wright He's the one who defined H, which is a path coefficient from the genotype to the phenotype. No one ever uses little h. They only use little h squared, the fraction of the variance that's added. What we're going to do is look at a parent offspring regression. So what I did is simulate one, and it's true that the covariance is half the additive variance. The variance is the sum of the three. Let's draw over here. The covariance of parent and offspring is a half BA. The variance of the parent, or it would be equally true the other way, is the sum of the three variance components. It's the phenotypic variance. The parents are assumed to be random drop. So the ratio of these two is this thing, and that, is, of course, is just half the heritability. So the slope, this is the formula for the slope of offspring on parent, that's this slope here. So if I fit my least squares a straight line through this, if I have a large enough sample of individuals and get the theoretical slope, it will be half the heritability. Okay, now there's one more thing before we finish and go to our R exercise that I want to do is say this also gives you a prediction of the response to selection. Now, the selection I'm going to use is an animal breeder type selection. I am going to say, suppose we breed from parents, from one of the parents. We say we measure our cows and our bulls, and let's say we're doing dairy production. We measure milk yielded by cows. We don't have a measurement on the bulls because they don't give milk. And we measure daughters, and we measure their milk production. And we get this scatter plot of parent offspring pairs, and we fit a regression line to it. And we say to ourselves, well, what would happen if I bred from this individual, if I pick up an individual who happens to be 11.9 on this scale? Okay. Well, what the regression predicts is that on average, the offspring that I get will be on the regression line. Now, I should say, when there's lots of genes, and lots doesn't have to be very many here, even a modest number of genes, then this distribution is going to be a bivariate normal distribution, because each of these variables is a sum of uncorrelated parts. And to that extent, it'll be normal this way, normal that way. It'll be jointly normal. It'll be a bivariate normal distribution. And the regression line then gives you the prediction of the average result of breeding from a parent who's here, okay, from a mother who's there. And if we say to ourselves, okay, let's truncate. Let's say I'm only going to breed from mothers who have at least this much milk that they give. So that's the cutoff or the truncation point. Here are the individuals we're breeding from. They are a combination of individuals who have different values on this scale. The average of the selected individuals is this, let's say. This is what's called the selection differential. It's how far above the population, the original population, is the average of the individuals from whom you are breeding. And what we find is that the response, the average response, is an average of what the response would be at each of these points, weighted properly to get you this mean. And that turns out to be just what you would get if you start from the mean of the selected individuals, bounce off the regression line, where the slope is half the heritability. So now what you can see is choosing individuals, let's say 1.8 units above the population mean, gets you a response that is a half h squared times that by just the geometry. Now, if you're selecting on both parents, if you're not using a trait like milk yield, but you're
you're selecting like body weight or something like this, leaving out some complications. You get a result which is that it's called the breeder's equation, and that is that the response in one generation of truncation of a simple form of selection is the heritability times the selection differential. So in the hands of Jay Lush, for example, and his students, this became important in using these variance components and the strength of selection and the selection differentials that you could achieve. They could make predictions of what the response to selection would be. We shall see a version of this for natural populations, propounded by Russ Landy, that involves slopes of mean fitness plotted against phenotype. There is a natural population version of the of that. So with that, I finish the, I've now taught you all of quantitative genetics. And what we have is a quick R exercise. Did all of you bring some? I emailed you all. All of you bring computers if you could set up. And I gave you a link to the exercise. All I'm really asking you to do is to run those three functions. I gave you three functions. They're called one is called what is this called? Plot Brownian up. If I get these names wrong. And that's really identical to what you ran last time. Another is plot to tree, and it has an argument A, and the argument is you're imagining a two-species evolutionary tree. We haven't got to evolutionary trees yet, so this is getting ahead of the game. We're imagining a lineage going along through time, changing according to Brownian motion. What I'll be getting into next time is to tell you that a genetic drift in a Fisherian character is going to cause something very much like Brownian motion. And also there are forms of natural selection that can do the same. So we're modeling evolutionary change as a result of drift and or selection by Brownian motion. And what we're going to do is say that A is the fraction of the time the two lineages have in common. So A might be 0.44 out of a total time span of 1. And finally, I'm going to the other one is plot to CORR car. And again, the same argument A. And what that does is this many times and gives you a plot of the two lineages phenotypes against each other. So give it a try. I will try. And holler as soon as it doesn't work. See if I can get it up here. Plot Brownian up. Somehow when I do it over here on this machine, it gives me tiny little plots, but I can make them bigger. So there is a plot of a Brownian motion process, which is moving on a horizontal scale, and it's going up in time. I also get these tiny little numbers next to it. We saw that last time. Plot to tree. I go in the order of the three that I gave you. So here I'm doing for 0.6. And one thing you can do is just use your up arrow key and your return key and hit them alternately, and you can execute it again and again and get a feel for outcomes.
and then finally do that plot to car, which will show you the result of doing that 400 times in terms of the final phenotypes in the two lineages. So let me let you do that and shut up and respond to any questions. Have you all got the functions? Anybody doesn't have the functions?
So plot two tree doesn't work with whole numbers, 0 and 1?
Well, 0 is the very bottom of the plot and 1 is the very top. And
right.
It's so gonna, something is gonna go, I...
Oh, it's having trouble with plotting, not with
it, I,
the proportion.
Yeah, I think what will happen there is if you go above 1, it won't have anything to plot when it calls upon itself to plot. And so don't go beyond 1, up above 1 or down below 0. I think it might or might not work at 1. But at 0.99 it would work.
Does not work at 1.
1 means 1.
And there's 1,000 steps here, so as long as you're, you know, I think the highest it would work at might be about 0.999 or something. Anyway. Yeah, if you want to
repeat, all you have to do is up arrow return.
Yeah. So what you should get from this is a feel for how those two values in two different species that are related to each other depends upon their degree of relationship. And after you've done that a while, switch to plot two car to see what would happen with 400 runs. Next time I'm going to give you an R exercise which will involve an imaginary quantitative character and you'll watch it changing through time due to genetic drift. It'll be simulated.
Does R must be inferior to 1 or so in the last function?
That what?
Does A must be inferior to 1 in the
must
last?
Must be below 1 and above 0.
Yeah, even for the last, for the two correlations.
Yes.
I think the correlation, they can be perfectly correlated.
You can go up to 1. If you go above 1, I won't be held responsible for what happens.
But you can go to 1.
Yeah. I think actually, if you go above 1, it'll crash, yeah. Because it tries to set up an array that's. It gets in trouble. Tries to set up an array of negative length or something like that. I didn't guard it against that. I know you all want to go past 1 and below 0. You really want to, but I'm asking you to be reasonable. You'll try different values of A and you'll get a sense of how the covariance of the two different tips, the two species, is dependent on that.
Can we simulate the multiple branches?
In theory, yes, I just didn't write the program. You know, you can write a general program that reads in a coded representation of the tree and sets up arrays for all the branches and does this, yeah. But that's not what this does. This only does 2. I think I'm going to stop recording.